Hello, and welcome to another episode of Naturally Speaking. We all know that behind every piece of exciting research has been months of hard labour writing funding applications. And so in this episode, James Buckley and myself, James Grecian, will be focusing on how to source research funding and how to make your application stand out from the crowd.
We'll be getting tips and advice from three experienced grant writers, Barbara Mabel, Neil Metcalf and Kathy Dunlop.
Naturally Speaking. Naturally Speaking.
What we should probably do go first is introduce ourselves briefly. So, Kathy, if you want to start first, just be introduced yourself.
Okay. So, I'm a final year PhD student, and I assume that I've been invited along to speak about research grants because I raised all the research money for my PhD myself with the help of my supervisor. So
That was why we chose you.
I'm still in shock how that's happened, but.
I'm Barbara Mabel. I'm a reader in the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine, and I have the job of reviewing all the grants internally as the research coordinator.
And I'm Neil Metcalf, a professor in the same institute, and I've been involved in applying for lots of grants and also getting some of them. But also I've sat on various panels assessing grant applications as well.
So there are four main topics for discussion in this episode. We'll be talking about sources for getting funding, both small and large research grants. We'll then look at how to start writing a research grant, how you go about selling your research, and common mistakes to avoid to increase your chances of being successful in your applications.
So it seems like a good place to start just by kind of going through a few of the places that we can get funding from. There's a number of different trusts and councils out there that can provide small grants from anywhere between £100 to £2,000. There are places like the British Ecological Society, the Society for Conservation Biology, the Society for Experimental Biology, Genetic Society, the People's Trust for Endangered Species, and within Glasgow, the Glasgow Natural History Society also offer small grants. So maybe...
So when we talk about small grants, we're really looking at ones that provide small amounts of money to assist with research during your PhD or in between posts, or in between sort of like master's, PhD, as an undergrad you can get sort of funding to do a studentship within with particular researchers in the institute. I think Kathy, you've probably applied for quite a few of these sort of small grants, so are they?
No, most of mine have actually come under sort of larger grants. My research is always seems to have been quite expensive in terms of travel costs, and also it's been quite fieldwork heavy with camera equipment. So mine have usually been very practical sort of based, and mine have been from, so its example is like ASEMBL, which is Association for European Marine Biology Collaborations, and also a NERC funding from the British, to go and work with the British Antarctic Survey.
So how do you find out about these?
I mean, I think a lot of these are very sort of, very, very specific sort of grants. A lot of them, it's just been kind of, word of mouth or within sort of particular areas that I've been interested in.
Barbara and Neil, I presume you both, I know, Barbara, you've applied for quite a few of summer studentships and things like that, and they've been from a range of the societies, is it? Research societies?
Most of them have been from the Genetic Society, but also the University Federation for Animal Welfare has studentships. They're a good source of small amounts of money. There's also unusual sources you don't think about, probably. So Anna Muir, a PhD student here, had money from the Scottish Mountaineering Trust to do her work in Scottish frogs. So it's worth looking at alternative sources.
But probably the first place to stop is to look at the different scientific societies that are relevant to your area of research, because depending on the society, they often have small grant schemes which are aimed at younger researchers or new researchers, which are never going to fund you for any length of time, but they could be useful backup funding to fill, as you said, to fill up between maybe your PhD and the first postdoc or some other, maybe to actually help you with your PhD. You've got to be careful with some of those because they may exclude PhD research from them, that some of them explicitly say that it can't be used for PhD work because they don't want to be kind of responsible for trying to fund a PhD which they can't really afford. So you have to check the small print on those, but they are a useful source.
I think that's an interesting point, isn't it? That a number of these smaller research grants, some of them can be compatible with doing a PhD or doing a postdoc, but some of them are much more tailored towards people that perhaps aren't being sort of funded through a PhD grant. They actually are tailored towards people to do work additional to or outside of their
yes, it's mostly aimed at if you've got some little kind of pet idea that you've thought about and you thought, well, I could tackle that in 3 months, maybe if I could get a student to help me over the summer or something like that. So just a small amount of money would enable you to actually tackle that one specific question. So they tend to be wanting a self-contained project that's just going to last a few weeks or months.
I suppose those things we've mentioned, those bodies for funding smaller pieces of research, they also fund travel as well. So a lot of the same places you could probably go to and ask for funding or help towards covering costs to go to conferences, both in the UK and further afield as well. So I suppose that's... They're useful for both the research and also the travel and
I found the university, the Mark Robertson one within the universities, and they've been very generous in terms of travel grants.
Is that a one specific?
I went to Clipperton Island in the Pacific, and they supplied me with a travel grant to get me there.
We can put a link about that on the website, and we'll have some links, I think, to some of these smaller research smaller funding bodies and smaller sort of research grants. As well as the smaller research grants, in the future, many of us will probably be wanting to try and apply for bigger research grants, and that's quite key, I think, to maintaining a career in science, as I'm sure Barbara and Neil will attest to. So I think there's a whole range of these, but perhaps we could look at some of the sort of the, perhaps some ones that people have had experience with here. So, I mean, Cathy, have you been applying for any sort of larger research grants?
Recently, I'm just applying for a fellowship with Monterey Bay Aquarium.
That's in Los Angeles.
In California. I should be quite interested to hear like your guys' point of view on applying for fellowships, because that's the first one that I've ever applied for. So I hope, fingers crossed, I'm doing it properly.
Is that funded by the National Science
Foundation? No, I think it's an internal scholarship they have. But it was one where I had to contact a supervisor there. And then we sort of, he liked my idea, so we've been working on the proposal together, which has been a good learning process for me, even if I don't get it. Just having that practice of, you know, collaborating with a large group of people to get a proposal written.
Yes, I suppose for people trying to start out in research and carve their own research path, I suppose fellowships are quite key, aren't they, really? There's a whole host of fellowships. I don't know how both of you started out. Neil, how did you...
I was a postdoc on a postdoc research assistant to begin with for 2 years, and then that was a grant that was kind of extended for a further 2 years, and then I got a research council fellowship at that point. To get a research council fellowship, it's quite difficult to get one straight after your PhD, because you normally need a reasonable number of publications on your CV before you're taken seriously, and most people don't have that immediately at the point of finishing their PhD.
What's reasonable?
How long's a piece of string? I guess you're probably talking, for say a NERC fellowship, you're probably talking at least half a dozen first author papers, I think. Okay. What do you say, Barbara?
Well, they've recently gotten rid of the junior NERC fellowships, so now you would need more, probably.
Probably even more than that, yeah.
So there was a junior and a senior also NERC fellowship.
Advanced, yes. It was more flexible in the past than it's now become. So now they're the same, really, as the BBSRC, which they only really have the one fellowship scheme, which is for a 5-year fellowship, which is obviously a fantastic thing to get, but obviously the bar is then set much higher in terms of your own credentials and applying for it. So, yeah, you're probably more talking about maybe 8 or 10 papers, I guess. Mm. Which, you know, don't think anyone's going to have that when they come immediately out of their PhD. So you need to get a couple of years of at least of postdoc funding.
And that's quite a key thing for applying for fellowship. I suppose we should also mention that when we say a lot about these different acronyms, and it's so easy to sort of forget that people might not have heard of them. So NERC, for example, is the Natural Environment Research Council. The BBSRC is the Biology and Biotechnology Research Scientific Research Council.
Technology and Biological Sciences Research Council.
Thank you, Neil. And that's a clear clap about that. There's a whole range of others getting towards the medical, so the Medical Research Council.
Like Welcome and things like that.
Engineering, yes. Physical Sciences. These are all government funded sort of research council. I suppose there are also charitable ones as well. So,
sure. Marie Curie Fellowship, for example. So Marie Curie Foundation is one that's a charitable foundation that's providing funding for fellowships for postdocs.
Some of these are
Marie Curie can be quite a range of.
Yeah, so Marie Curie can be a whole range of things, but you have to take it overseas. Country. So you have to move countries. Is the main thing. There's also the Leverhulme Trust as well. Is another place to look for postdoc funding.
Yeah. There's quite a sort of a wide range of these, actually. So most of these will do both fellowships, but also bigger grants for more established scientists. Is that right?
Most of them, yeah. And I mean, if you're just finishing your PhD, a good thing to do is to try to get in touch with someone who you might think was going to put in a grant and be named on it, because then you have a better chance of getting the postdoc, and it can make the grant stronger as well if there's a named person.
Okay, so that's pretty quite useful for many people thinking about getting towards the end of their PhD, or even getting towards the end of a postdoc and thinking about a postdoc more tailored towards their needs, seeing if they can, because I suppose for some of these grants, only sort of established or permanent members of staff can apply.
That's right, yes. So they don't necessarily have to be permanent, but they have to have a contract that lasts longer than the grant will last. So if you're applying for, say, a three-year grant, then the person has to be in at least a three-year, more likely five-year or permanent position, otherwise they're not eligible to apply for it.
Okay. Within all of these different sort of big grant funding organisations, are some particularly geared towards really large projects and others more focused around, or are they all sort of, what sort of size of grants would you get from these different organisations? Where would you be able to get most money from, for example?
So they change all the time. So Neil has just gotten one of the most prestigious ones there is in the European Research Council. They used to give individual grants, and now they fund fewer individuals, but for larger amounts of money.
Yeah, so that's, they have three different schemes now. They keep changing it, as Barbara said, that they now have a starting grant scheme for people that have been finished their PhD a few years ago. There's a consolidating one for those that have been a little bit longer since their PhD, and then the advanced one, which is for the kind of old lags like me. But they are fantastic grants in the sense that they offer a five-year grant and the resources to kind of back that up. And another nice thing about them is that they don't have an agenda as to what they want to fund. They just want to fund interesting science. So you don't have to fit any kind of priorities or kind of strategic areas that they're trying to specialise in. So unlike most of the other funding bodies, certainly the government ones, which now are becoming more and more targeted in what they want to see funded. So the research councils are becoming more prescriptive. NERC's not too bad yet, but PBSRC is very narrow in what they really want to fund. They will fund other things as well, but you're kind of fighting a losing battle in a sense that you've got to be that much better or more interesting.
I suppose we'll come back to that in a bit more detail later on, because I think that's quite an important point, isn't it? To think that there are different, you've got to work out perhaps what research you're trying to do before you then go and work out which funding bodies are best able to fund you.
Yes, you've really got to look at the funding, but you can't kind of hawk your pet project around all these different bodies, because they all have different agendas as to what they're interested in funding, and you've got to tailor it to what they're actually interested in. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. And
so on that note, like how do you actually go about starting to write one of these? You know, give us some pointers, maybe like broad advice on how do you actually start trying to write a grant for one of these applications?
Well, I don't know. You need an idea, which it sounds simple, but I mean, if you don't have a really interesting original idea, you're kind of wasting your time.
That's what you have to do, a lot of research to make sure it's original.
I know that's the difficult, especially at a young stage or an early stage of your career. You're trying to think, well, what is original compared to what's already been done? And that's, so it's very difficult to jump into a new area and come up with an idea which nobody's thought of before. Because if it's that original, it probably means it's completely impractical and it just won't work.
So you come up with an idea, you start formulating questions around that idea, and then you look for a sensible source of funding that might be somewhere to apply, and then you hone in on that? Or do you
think which
people you'd be likely to get funding for, and then...
I suppose it's quite key to work out, you know, if you had an idea, how would you necessarily know where the best place is to go and get funding? Can they give you feedback?
So every funding body will have a strategic plan of some kind, and it's best to check that and make sure that your science fits in with what they want to fund. And so I would start early thinking about ideas a long time before you put anything on paper. Try to work out what your question is, how you might answer it, who you might want to work with. Often collaborative grants are more highly funded now, and then try to find the most appropriate source. So one of the things about the research councils is they talk to each other now, and so you used to be able to put in a similar grant to two different agencies, but now you can't.
Also, if you don't get funded, then you may have to change your idea substantially or just revise it slightly to try to send it to a new place in your organisation.
You can sometimes get away with tinkering with it, but you certainly have to kind of change the kind of the slant of it or the kind of the main selling point a little bit. Otherwise, you know, you'll get spotted as being putting it in twice. And I think if you're not sure which is the right place to send it, then you shouldn't hesitate to actually contact them and ask them, because certainly the research councils, they're only too happy to provide feedback on if you're kind of unsure whether they're the right place or not, then you can ask them and they'll say whether or not it fits their remit or not, whether they can think of someone more appropriate. So you shouldn't hesitate to actually contact them.
And at this point, Marie Curie is the one, I think, that might stand out as being the place where you can resubmit the
You can resubmit
year.
Marie Curie.
So they'll give you a score, and if it gets rejected, you can then build on the reviewer's comments and then resubmit the following year, hopefully having improved the grant.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how many times you keep going before you either give up or it gets funded.
Do some of them submit a smaller idea? I know the Leverhulme Trust, you submit a pre-proposal, don't you?
Which
they then screen, and then that goes through to the next one. Yeah. We write a large proposal. Do any other of the big major research funding bodies do that?
I've just applied for Prince of Monaco Fund, and they do the same thing.
So you submit a pre-proposal?
Yeah, just a pre-proposal, which is it's very specific and quite small for what you're wanting to do.
It's quite common for special initiatives or larger collaborative grants to have a pre-proposal stage, rather than everybody wasting their time if they only want to fund certain
And I think
things.
When writing, you shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that you don't need to care very much about the pre-proposal bit because it's only short, because bear in mind that that's all the assessors are going to have in front of them at that point. So even though you've got the rest of it in your head as to what will be the main proposal, you've got to sell absolutely everything in that 2 pages or whatever it is.
Would that be the same even in some of the, where you submit a full proposal, I suppose there may be summary stages, are those sections quite critical for
absolutely
getting funding? So you've got to make sure that they are.
Because grant panels, often you get 30 proposals to read and people aren't going to read the whole thing, they're going to read the summaries, and often that's all they'll read, so that has to be the strongest point.
How long do they spend? Maybe 10 minutes?
10 minutes on the train for each proposal, probably, on the way down to the meeting.
Yeah, it might have taken you 6 weeks to write, but they're going to dismiss it much quicker than that, unless you can really sell it to them, which, I mean, I know we're moving on now to think about how is the best way to do it. You've got to grab their attention really early on. So the first paragraph or 2 paragraphs of your main section of text has got to really sell the idea. You can't spend 2 pages finally getting round to the point of it. You've got to say, I usually think of putting the last, say, 2 sentences of the first paragraph have got to conjure up what it is that's interesting about the next 8 pages, because otherwise you've lost them.
You've got to have their interest at the very.
You've got to have their interest, and you've got to say why it's interesting, why it's new. Because I mean, so many proposals fail because they're perfectly plausible, and they possibly haven't been done before, but they're just not interesting enough.
A lot of people are too close to their own research, and they think this is obviously wonderful, but you have to convince someone who knows nothing about your subject area why it's interesting and important. Increasingly, because of the funding pressures, you have to justify why it's relevant not only to science but to society as well.
Yeah, so I suppose that is that an increasing sort of theme amongst most of these funding bodies, that you have to try and quickly sell a research, not just to a scientist that may be in the same field as you, but to the lay people, the lay person.
The government funded ones. And then some of the ones that are trusts, often the big challenge there is that the panel aren't scientists quite often. So you have to make your proposal interesting. So it doesn't have to have a direct societal benefit, but it has to be understandable to a lay audience.
For example, which sort of?
The Leverhulme Trust.
Okay.
So that would be non-scientists who'd be.
It could be. There'd be a mixture, but there'd definitely be some non-scientists.
So the Leverhulme, they send it out, if it gets as far as the full stage, full proposal stage, they will send it out to scientific referees, but the people who evaluate those reports that the referees write are non-scientists. Mm-hmm. So if you've not made it sound interesting, then they may be swayed by, if the referees are convinced, that may be enough. But if the referees are a bit kind of lukewarm, you're never going to win if your own proposal doesn't sound interesting.
So I suppose it's really important just to know who your audience is, tailoring it to them.
It doesn't necessarily mean you've got to dumb it down, but you've just got to say, what would be different if this was funded and if it worked out? You know, how would things change? Mm-hmm. And if you can't honestly say that anything much would change, then you're not really necessarily going to convince anyone else, because you've got to say, well, if we knew this, if I was able to show this, then the whole field would advance in this particular, we'd know so much more about this, we'd be able to you can't, you don't overdo it. You can't say, well, we're going to, you know, halt climate change, or we're going to, you know, cure people of cancer.
And I don't think they wouldn't expect you to be saying those things.
No,
that would probably be bad, wouldn't it, for you, if you said
you've got to claim too much. Yeah, you can't kind of claim to be doing more than you are. But on the other hand, you've got to bring out what is genuine. You know, if you're going to say, I'm going to develop this new technique which will allow us to do X, Y, and Z, then you know, people can get a feel for, okay, things are going to be different.
You've really got to show how you can move the field forward with your research and really explain that in a succinct way. In this case, lay people, if you, in inverted commas, can understand.
Yeah, so that in your, you can't, obviously, if you think back to that first paragraph of the proposal, then you've got to explain somewhere in the proposal exactly why this is true, but in the first few sentences you can say, well, at the end of that paragraph you can say, if successful, this project will do X, Y, and Z. And then later on you can say how it's going to do that. You don't want to get bogged down into methods at, you know, this early stage. You've just got to sell what it is that's different, you know, what's new about it.
Is there a trade-off between doing something completely novel versus doing something that's tackling an interesting question, in fact, some bit, aspects of it are novel, but the majority of it's quite sound? Are certain areas more liable to fund novel, sort of like cutting-edge stuff, and other people are more, you know, happy with the solid
science? So again, that depends on the funder. So BBSRC wants you to be pretty much finished the experiment, so you have no untested methods, at least. NERC have traditionally been a bit more blue skies, but they're under pressure, I think, to have more achievable objectives. And but places like Leverhulme are specifically designed for wacky ideas that aren't fundable from somewhere else.
Yeah. Yes, because one of the boxes you need to complete with the Leverhulme Trust is why you're applying to them rather than a more perhaps conventional, should we say, funding body. And one reason can be that the research councils would require you to have a lot more pilot data, a lot more previous experience in this study system, and therefore at this stage you'd not be fundable. But the only way to get that pilot data is to get some funding, therefore you're effectively applying for this, even though you know that there's a risk involved. I mean, that's depending on the funding body, and you can normally find out something about this from reading up on the websites and so on, but you can get a feel for how risk averse they are. So some, especially research councils, are getting more and more risk averse. They just don't want to put money into things which might fail. And so they ask the referees, okay, they normally ask this for a thing called risk reward. How big are the risks that something's going to go wrong, and how big are the rewards if it goes right? And they will fund it, certainly NERC will fund it, if they think the rewards are great enough, even if there is some risk. But there's still that element, you're putting doubt into the referee's mind if it's not clear that you know how to do everything. So the methods. So either that means you've got to have some pilot data there, or you can say, "This is such a, I haven't done this before, but everyone else has done it before, and so I can, you know, it's a well-worked technique, it's a well-worked methodology. I know I can do it because it's, you know, it's been worked out by other people. So that's okay. You don't have to do it personally, as long as you can convince
it." I suppose a nice little link here is that some of the small research grants you mentioned right at the beginning can often be used to sort of generate good pilot data, kind of.
Absolutely.
So I suppose to even senior academics might apply for these smaller grants, so that you can generate a bit of pilot data, and then that, I presume, would substantially increase the chance that your application will get to the latter stage.
Yeah, and because if you're applying to a research council, it's really important then to get that pilot data into your application. So you put in a graph or a table or something, some data to show that you know what you're talking about. Or at least you can pretend that you're talking about.
So we've collected a little bit of pilot data. We've written a nice question with a really good impact statement that talks at the top in a good summary about what we're hoping to do and how we're going to do it.
So we're selling our research.
We're selling our research. What do we do next? Like, how do we either boost that grant so that we can get it funded, or how do we get it reviewed? I mean, do we show it around a few friends? Do we do it within the department? Do we go externally? What's the process like?
So the more people you can get to read it, the better. And it's a really good idea to get people outside of your own field to read it, because often the panels that are evaluating it will be from a broad range of backgrounds, and you want to be able to sell it. When I first came here, I came from the Canadian system, and it takes a while to get used to a new funding agency. So I was on a NERC panel, and that was extremely helpful because you knew what people were looking for. And so that you can help other people then to try to get across those things. I also had a completely ruthless help someone giving me advice when at Felicity Hunting Grove when I first came. So if I could convince her, I could convince anyone, and that was great. So that's the role I'm taking on now.
So find your harshest critic, and then if you can get through them, there's a good chance that you might get through.
Yeah.
To your parents.
You really do need people who are going to be merciless in it, because you want to know the worst possible criticism before you submit it and try and guard against it.
How long did it take to go through that process? I presume you have to give yourself a fair length of time.
There's a writing stage, and obviously people write at different speeds, so it's a bit difficult to come up with a common figure for that. But given the fact that you need to show it to other people, and you've got to give them, you know, a week or so, you can't expect them to just give it back to you the next day, although Barbara is amazing at doing that, but don't take her for granted on that one. You've got to give them, say, a week to look over things. You've then got to revise it based, they might have torn it to shreds, in which case you've got to pick up the pieces again. So you're talking about 6 weeks before the deadline, I think, really, at the point at which you start writing. Mm. And really, you wouldn't have had the idea before that, so you should be, probably 2 months or so to be thinking of the idea, starting to read up on things. You can't do it in the last week. It's utterly impossible.
3 months to go from kind of like conception to give you enough time, so over the last kind of maybe 6 weeks, as you say, to hand it around the department and make sure you get lots of feedback.
Yeah.
And the most stressful thing is if you are trying to make changes an hour before the deadline and the whole system crashes. So early is always better.
Are there other delays as well, that other reasons why you might, that might cause delay, that you need to think about when...
Costings. Okay. So you have to get the university involved in salary costings. You want to have to get quotations from companies. They're often slow. Sometimes you have to get approval from.
So you can't just make things up, can you?
No.
You can't just wing it.
I mean, it depends on if you're doing a small project grant. So if you're just applying for £500 from a charity, it depends on their application procedure. But you may well get away with doing it fairly rough and ready at the last minute. But you know where you can do that for a bigger application. Because there's all sorts of things which you probably don't think about to begin with, which is that there'll be, depending on the funding scheme, there may be overheads that have to be calculated, and they'll be calculated in different ways according to different funding schemes.
So overheads are they're the costs that are required to run the university, are they?
Yes.
Or the university thinks it costs to run the university.
Yes, which, I mean, there's always disputes between universities and funding bodies as to how much should be provided in this kind of thing, which is above, we have no control over that. But basically, most funding bodies will pay, unless they're charities, will pay something over and above what you think is going to cost you. So you have what you need for the equipment, what you need for consumables, what you need for travel, and what you need for staff, your own salary if it's a case of a fellowship, or if you're going to appoint a postdoc or some other kind of assistant, their salaries. But on top of that, there's the cost, what keeps the heating and lighting going in the university, and who pays for the salary of the person, the administrator who's been just devising these costings for you, all that kind of background cost, which can really inflate the total cost of the project. And you might suddenly think, how on earth are they think that's competitive, because it suddenly looks like a huge grant. Well, you shouldn't worry, because everyone else is in the same boat. So every other university is also adding on this bit, and it's agreed by the funding councils that that's going to happen. So they're not, alarmed at the costing you've come up with.
So down the line of things that you might not have thought about, we've got some common mistakes that people have made on either grants that you guys have reviewed, obviously naming no names, but this idea of, forgetting to cost, like the full economic costings, for example, an hour before you hand in your grant.
So the biggest thing is people make grants too complicated. They think they have to put in 10 experiments, when for a three-year grant, you probably just want 3 big questions and clear methods that map onto those objectives. And the best objectives are ones that are questions or hypotheses, rather than just saying, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, because that's not very convincing. The other thing people don't do well is they'll explain what's been done in the past in the literature, but not where the gaps in knowledge lie that they're going to fill. And that's a big thing. So after every experiment you describe from the past, you should have a however statement about limitations or what could be done next, and how you're going to fill those holes.
So keep it clear, but also provide room for where you see where your research could expand, and where you could do more, when you could do.
You have to be careful, because for a three-year grant, you have to be very specific about what you're going to achieve, and in the significance, you could suggest where it might go in the future, but you don't want to have a lot of, I might do this and I might do that, because that's not very convincing either.
I mean, that's just another part of the game, really, because you know that research never proceeds in a totally predictable way, and everyone knows that. Mm-hmm. Yet it's the convention that you have to say, I'm going to do this experiment, and then I'm going to do that experiment, and I'm going to do that thing. And so it's all mapped out exactly in principle what you're going to do, or you and your colleagues are going to do over the 3 years. And you mustn't say things like, well, we'll see what happens, and then we'll, you know, third year we'll just do the most sensible thing, because everyone says, well, that's vague.
That leads on to one thing I was going to ask about, sort of what sort of promises you have to make in terms of what your output's going to be within these.
I think, well, the terms of the output, you, there was an interesting point made by the representative of the BBC at a meeting I was at recently, where they said that, contrary to what some people think, in the kind of impact stuff, which they now insist on us writing, they're not expecting us to say at the time of writing what we think the impact will be, because they know, as well as we do, that we don't know what the results are going to be. If we knew what the results were, there's no point in doing science. So that's the whole point of the proposal, is to find out things. So you can't say how you're going to use those facts when you don't know what they are at the stage. But what you do have to say is how you're going to convey that information to the relevant people. So you don't know what the information is yet, but you have to have a strategy in place to say, I'm going to target the scientific audience by writing papers and conferences and doing obvious things like that. But then there may also be a public outreach aspect, which is to inform the general public of whatever it is that I find. And so I'm going to do that by going to schools and talking to school kids, or taking part in the Glasgow Science Festival, or whatever it is. So those, you've got to say specific things there, even though you don't know what actual form they're going to take. But you've got to say, these are the ways I'm going to do it.
So I think that would be a good place to end today's podcast episode. We hope you've picked up some useful hints and tips to start writing what would hopefully be successful research grants. We should definitely thank our three guests for their contributions today, and of course, you all for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast, and you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.